So I'm talking about how to not invent kernel interfaces. My name is Arndt Bergmann. I'm from the IBM Linux Technology Center over in Böblingen, Germany. So you might wonder why this talk is not how to invent kernel interfaces or how to create kernel interfaces. Well, generally, it's a bad thing to do. Don't ever write something that has an interface between kernel and user space, because you will get it wrong. So you could also call this how not to invent kernel interfaces, or even how to not invent kernel interfaces. So the best idea is not do something new, but use what's already there, and try not to come up with something completely new. And well, the rest is details about this. So this is the outline of my talk. At first, I'll talk about some very general concepts of interface design. Then I will go into some detail of system calls in general, and some more specific ones, and in particular socket interfaces. Then there will be a part about file systems, namely virtual file systems that are only existing inside of the kernel. And then I will be doing a bonus session on ABI emulation, if we have time for that. The first general concept about interface design is taste. Everyone has different tastes. Some have good taste in interface design, some have a bad taste. So how do you tell what is good taste? And how do you know if the others share your taste? One of the problems is also that it changes over time. So when something used to be a very good idea a few years ago because everyone liked it, that might not be the case anymore, because we've come up with something completely different now. So what are hard criteria? The most important criterion for taste in interfaces is simplicity. Why do you want to do something simple? Biggest reason is, if you do it complex, people will not understand it and use it in incorrect ways and write bugs. And you don't want people to write bugs when they use your interfaces, because that makes your code look bad. And if you have something as complex as, say, the socket interface, people will just misuse it. On the other hand, if you do it too simple, you will miss out on something. You'll probably forget some. So it should always be as simple as possible, but don't go any simpler, because then it will just not do the job. The second important criteria for interface design is consistency. So if there are multiple ways to do something, and other people have done something similar before, you should try to make it look as similar as possible to what the others have done. Not always it's really important to do exactly what the others have done, because simplicity is still more important than this. But if you have the choice between two equally simple options, then do just what the other person has done, even if it may look bad to you. And as a consequence of this, use the right tool for the right job. There are often many different kinds of interface that you can use. We'll come to that later. But and most of the time, you can use one interface to replace another equally. But you have to understand what people are expecting to see from an interface, and then decide on the one that best fits the job that you want to do. So the mother of all interfaces, that's a system call. In Linux, we have a few hundred system call interfaces. x86, by the time I wrote the slides, which has been a few months ago, we had 323 system calls. I believe we have already increased that again. However, every single system call goes through a hopefully long review cycle, where we find all the bugs and tell people to write documentation when they haven't already done it, because writing documentation for a system call will also find bugs in the interface. The biggest problem of all system call interfaces is that you can never change them. If you get it wrong, you're screwed. If you have If you're missing an argument in a system call, you have, let's say, the wait system call, as it was originally. I don't know how many arguments it took, but they kept adding new versions of wait system call. We have wait for, we have wait pid, always adding one more argument, and you still need to carry along the old version of the system call because any old application might still be using it. If you look at very old Unix, this is the oldest version I could find. This is the full list of all system calls. And you can actually do, in theory, everything that you could do with a modern Linux system just using these system calls or even fewer of them. One example, assume you didn't have the exit system call. What could you do? There could be a character device that you open, and as soon as you write to that character device, the current thread exits. And in a similar way, you could replace every system call with something else, and you can replace almost everything else with a system call. But it's usually not a good idea to do that. The biggest mess of a system call we have is the IO control, or IO kernel. You can't even pronounce that thing. I mean, how would you pronounce that? Yeah, exactly. We have at least three different answers already. not only the pronunciation, it's also not type safe. You just pass a void pointer, and the kernel might do anything with it. It doesn't even have to be a pointer. You could just pass in a number. Some IO controllers do that. And since you always need to write some C code or some other programming language code to use it, it's very hard. You cannot script it from a shell script. Like, you can read a file from a shell script, but you cannot do an IO control usually. Then there's a problem with 32-bit emulation. That's actually something that we have in all system calls. So whenever you have a new system call, you need to make sure that it runs on a 64-bit kernel if you have a 32-bit program accessing it, because the data structures are laid out differently. But IO control is by far the worst problem, because every single IO control number can have different format of the arguments, and we need to have some conversion code in the kernel that transforms 32-bit user space data to the 64-bit kernel data structures. Yeah, or try to design them in a way that you don't need it, but most people get it wrong. And there's one final big problem with IO control, that some people just use IO control because it's easy to get in. If you actually want a system call, like we had in the exit example, if you actually need to implement something like exit, you could always do it with an IO control on a character device. And if you're lucky, no one will notice that going in. But instead, you should have probably done a system call or some other interface that gets better reviewed. Sometimes we even have IO controls that keep changing over time because some driver author isn't careful and doesn't know that these ABIs are stable, and that causes problems for all users. So, in short, do not use IO control ever, right? Well, actually not. Don't believe all the bullshit you hear, because sometimes there are good reasons to use IO control. First of all, it's well established, and if you write a device driver for something like a serial port, you will need to use IO control to be consistent with other serial port drivers. It's also easy to use it for prototyping system calls. Like in KVM, we have an example where we're using IO control where we should really be using system calls. But for now, it's, well, at least in the beginning, it has been a good idea to use IO control because it's easy to do in a loadable module, unlike a system call. And you can add new IO control numbers to an existing interface without changing the style of the interface completely. This is also a disadvantage, but it's also an advantage.
You don't have to change the IO control numbers with every kernel update.
Right, you don't have to change the IO control numbers with every kernel update. There's sometimes people who are told that IO control is really bad, and they try to come up with something different. This is an example from the kernel, from the InfiniBand drivers. So what they actually did was to re-implement IO control using the write system call. So if you write to a file descriptor that looks to the kernel almost like an IO control, you get a pointer, and you get a length. Actually, I think they're ignoring the length here. But basically, in the write callback of the driver, they are interpreting the data that gets written as if it was an IO control data structure and not actually reading. The kernel doesn't actually read from the data structure, but it also writes to the data structure, which is the opposite of what you expect from a write system call. And there's a huge table with subcommands. So there are like 80 or so subcommands in that driver, depending on what are the first bytes in the data structure that you write to the character device, it will do some completely different operation. So this should just have used IO control in here. Okay, let's get over this with IO control. There's another interface that everyone needs to know about. This is sockets. They have actually been around quite long, even before Linux. These were introduced in 4.2 BSD, and I'm not aware of any operating system currently that is in production use and does not support these sockets. It's even used in Windows. And the Linux implementation is also used for not only networking, but other kinds of interfaces. We have, first of all, Unix domain sockets, then we have Netlink, which I'll come to next. And you can do quite a lot with sockets, but it's also a pretty complex interface. It's very hard to use. And if someone was to reinvent the socket interface and tried to submit a patch adding this kind of interface to the kernel now, it would just get rejected. And people would say, you can't do it. It's too complex and have to come up with something better than that. But because of the consistency with other operating systems, we just have to do it. There's no way around this interface. Now, Netlink is one class of addresses in sockets that is used just internally in the kernel. Internally in a system to communicate between user space and the kernel. This is even more complex than just bare sockets. And it used to be really fashionable to use this Netlink interface for all sorts of things. But at some point, people realized that it doesn't really give you advantages over IO control because you still have the same problems with type safety. And now you also need to open a socket to do something useful with it. The one advantage that Netlink has is that it provides a way of doing asynchronous notification from the kernel to user space. So you can actually have a user space program waiting to get notified when the kernel does something. And the kernel can queue messages in there, which is pretty unique in the interfaces that are in wide use. But still, it's so complex that most of the time, you just shouldn't use it if you have an alternative. Another example why sockets are really, really bad is the ancillary data. Most of you will never have to use this, but it's still there, and it causes trouble for all kernel programs who want to do something with file systems and have to worry about file descriptors moving from one task to another, because there's actually a way to pass an open file from one process to another process through a socket that is shared by these two processes. And this is an example taken from the man page for the ancillary data. And basically, just boilerplate code, you just have to do it this way. And then suddenly, an open file pops up in one process that is shared with another process. And another example about sockets. So the wireless extensions are one of the most complex air control interfaces we have in the kernel. And they're based on sockets. So you not only have an IO control interface on a character device, which would be bad enough, but now you combine it with a socket. And the IO control data that you pass in not only has a file descriptor associated with it that tells it what device to operate on, but the wireless device is listed as ASCII text in there. So then the kernel will search for the device afterwards. You can basically just do it on any socket. There are device-specific IO controls that have a name associated with them, which is also even more unusual. So normally you have an IO control number and a file descriptor, and here you basically have neither of those. You have a name of an IO control to identify what it's doing, and you have a name of an interface. And this is where it gets really weird. And then, since they had only a limited range of IO control numbers, there are also sub-IO controls used to identify other operations because the number space was too small. And then someone said, well, you have to get rid of all this mess. This is too complicated. And the next step was to actually take this whole interface and move it to Netlink, which did not quite help because it was still the same interface. It had all the complexity that I just mentioned. It was just now using Netlink as a transport instead of IO control. And then later the Netlink stuff was removed again. Okay, something completely different. We have file systems in the kernel that are used for establishing new interfaces. There used to be the saying that everything in Unix is a file. Now we could say that everything in Linux is a file system. The first virtual file system we had was procfs, and that was originally used for process data. So if you run top or ps or something like that, it will scan through the files in procfs and show you all the data from there. It then became basically the place where you put any interface. So any driver that you wrote in the late 90s or early 2000, you would create a procfs file and then write some random data in there. And this got really, really messy. And then at some point, we stopped doing this, and you basically can't add new files in procfs for device drivers or anything like that. We still have new files sometimes that are related to processes, and that's still useful. But with the files in procfs, we have the same problem as with the system calls, that you basically can never change them. There might always be some user space program that relies on a specific data structure in there, or specific layout of the ASCII text. And the user space program might even make wrong assumptions about something that was never encoded in the kernel there and break even if you don't change it. And if the number of CPUs increases, proc CPU info is one of those examples where every architecture even has a different format in the file that you need to know about. This was supposed to get a lot better with SysFS. So SysFS was the new good solution to get rid of all problems that we had with procfs. It was actually meant to replace both IO control and procfs. And for a number of things, it actually did quite well. So there are some interfaces that don't make sense with an IO control and some other interfaces that don't make sense with procfs, but do work out really well with SysFS. So in there, you have one directory per device and for some other objects as well. And in that device, you can have attributes. And each of those attributes is just a number or a name or something like that. But still, it does not solve the ABI problem. So whenever you create a new file in SysFS in some device driver, you will have to maintain it forever. And this caused a number of problems. I think in late 2005, when the UDEV program relied on specific layout in SysFS, and that layout changed in both forward and backwards incompatible ways. And then you suddenly had distributions where you could not upgrade or downgrade the kernel anymore. This was really, really bad. Another file system that I started out writing is the SPU file system. This is very special purpose. So just like procfs, it contains a directory for virtual entity, in this case, virtualized synergetic processing unit, which is something you would have on the cell processor. You can see from my t-shirt that I'm working on that project. For example, the PlayStation 3 uses this. And for the SPU file system, we have one directory per entity and then lots of attributes in there. I think by now we have over 25. We should not have used so many of them because it gets really confusing. But it's still, I think, one of the better decisions that we made to have this basic layout. We also added two new system calls that are specific to the PowerPC architecture right now. These go along with the file system. So you actually have to run a system call to create a new directory in there because the existing system calls like makedir don't fit exactly in there. And another special purpose file system. This is probably the simplest file system we have in the kernel. I'm trying to change that in the future. Not by extending this one, but making it simpler for others. this is almost the whole file system that I'm showing you in a few slides. So just to show you what you currently need to do to create a file system with just a fixed set of files in there. You will register your file system. You fill out a small data structure, basically containing only a pointer to the getSuperBlock function. And the getSuperBlock function just calls getSuperBlock single or getSuperBlock sudo with the fillSuper operation. That fillSuper operation calls simple fillSuper with the data structure that has attached a list of file names and file operations. File operation is what many people know from character device drivers. So every character device has a file operations data structure. And there you can fill in read, write, IO control, and other operations. And then the NFS control file system also uses something called the simple transaction mechanism. That is basically something that can replace a system call or IO control or whatnot with a read and write access on a file, which is not completely different to an IO control, but it has the advantage that you can use it from a shell script. So you can write some data in for the file, have a data structure in there, and read back the results of an operation. And there you have a transaction write operation for this. We can just go back to, yeah, don't have a slide. When I actually did this slides some time ago, it occurred to me that we can do it simpler than this. There's quite a lot of boilerplate code that you need if you want to have a file system in the kernel and then dynamically create files from the kernel, but not from user space. That's something that, for example, DebugFS does, or SecurityFS, or also SPUFS. And I then looked at what DebugFS does internally. And I noticed that almost all the DebugFS code is pretty much generic. The only thing that's specific to DebugFS that could not be shared with other file systems is that when you create a file in DebugFS and do not tell it to use a specific parent directory, it will create it in the DebugFS root. Now we're getting this part out of the DebugFS implementation and moving the rest to libfs. We can end up with a single single function call to create a new file system, get back a dentry, and use that dentry to create further files in there. I hope this makes sense to some people. It should make sense if you have used DebugFS before. So basically, directory entry is the basic entity in these virtual file systems. It can be either a directory itself, or it can be a file. And if it's a file, you can attach an inode with file operations to it. Or if it's a directory, you can add further files in that directory. So I might very soon post a set of patches that just introduces these library helpers and then reduces all those virtual file systems by 200 lines each, which is all duplicated code. So I found the same, almost identical code in SecurityFS and DebugFS and a number of other places. Okay, one point about ABI emulation. I already mentioned with the IO controls that it's a huge problem if you have a 32-bit program running on 64-bit kernel, because they represent the same data structures in different ways. There are similar issues if you want to run a program that was originally compiled for a different operating system. We have this for a few operating systems. I believe we can run OSF1 binaries because the alpha port was originally done in a way that the ABI was largely the same. We have code for Solaris binaries. And we had at some point code for a lot of other PC-based Unix versions, like Xenix or OpenUnix and others. We also need some kind of emulation code for older version of system calls. When we find that we screwed up with the system call definition, had to add a new argument, had to extend the size of an argument, we still need the old interface so that users who compiled their applications earlier can still call that. And that's almost the same operation we need to do in the kernel, even if it's for a different purpose. I've got one example here, how we handle the get time of day system call. So get time of day returns you a time val and time zone data structure. You pass pointers to those, and these actually contain two integers of type long. And long is always 32-bit on older systems and 64-bit on 64-bit processors. So we have to convert them. So what we do in get time of day is the time val that we get, the time val pointer from user space, is given to the put time val 32 function, and that has its argument the kernel time val, which is just the 64-bit representation. And the put time val 32 is a function that takes two 64-bit integers and stores just the lower halves of that into a user space data structure. But at the core of this function, we just call the regular get time of day kernel function. And something like this has to be done for, let's say, two-thirds of all system calls that we have in the kernel. There are a few that are fortunately completely compatible, like getPID will just return the process ID, and that's always a 32-bit integer, or it's just the return register, so the size of the register is compatible in either way. You can see the put time val 32. So put user is a function that writes one integer to user space with the size of the target, and the input here can be any other size. So if you do any new system calls or IO controls, just try to make it compatible. Try to use the same data structures. If in doubt, use always 64-bit types, and then it will just work out. There's one, let's do this one first. Pointers are really interesting on the 390 architecture because they are actually 31-bit instead of 32-bit. And if you pass a user space pointer into kernel space, the upper bit has an undefined value. So what can happen is that the kernel interprets this as a 64-bit pointer and realizes it's outside of the addressable range, and then it will have to return a fault to user space or kill the user space program because it was accessing an invalid pointer. So every time you pass a 31-bit pointer into the kernel, you have to call the compat pointer function, and that masks out the upper bit and then interprets the rest as a 64-bit pointer. And so the lesson from this is, if you can avoid it, do not pass pointers into the kernel. So if you have a data structure in an I/O control, just have basic types in there, but do not have a pointer inside of the data structure to another data structure. Yeah, then we have a very interesting problem with the 64-bit integers, which is that the alignment on 32-bit x86 is different from all the other architectures that can have 64-bit and 32-bit CPUs and processes. So actually on x86, well, on 386, any 64-bit value will be aligned to 4 bytes instead of 8 bytes. And that means that the data structure below, the compat foo data structure, is 12 bytes in size on a 386 system, whereas on a x86 64 system, it will be 16 bytes, because the compiler will try to align the B member and then add some padding in there. And that has been quite a lot of people trying to do interfaces with data structures. So whenever you write a data structure that's used in a user space interface, try to make it so that there's no padding in there. Just either have explicit padding, have a reserved value in there, or put the 64-bit values first and then the 32-bit values. Still a question? Yep. This is how we do the compat I/O control handling in the kernel. So since there are so many different I/O control numbers and every one of them has a different data structure, we need to have a way to find out what we need to do with the pointer that gets passed into the kernel. Ideally, we do it in every driver does it by itself. So in the best case, the driver knows that all data structures are compatible. They use perfect padding. They don't use they don't use members that have different sizes. They don't use pointers or anything. So we can just use the same function to interpret the data in both 32-bit and 64-bit programs. And that's what we do up here. So we first look if there's a compat I/O control function that can point to the regular I/O control function of that driver, or it can point to a function that converts the native 32-bit data structure to the native 64-bit data structure. If we don't find that, we look through a hash table. And that hash table actually contains the I/O control number and a function to do the conversion between the two formats. One of my side projects is to get rid of that hash table. We've been shrinking that over the last few years significantly. So in the beginning, we had every single I/O control that the kernel knows about in that hash table. Now we have the majority of them inside of the device drivers. But there's still lots of them left, especially for networking. Almost all the socket I/O controls still go through that mechanism. And also many of those that are compatible, they're just listed as compatible. In that case, we call the regular sys I/O control function, like below here. And again, if you do a device driver, please make sure that all your data structures are compatible, so we don't need to add any more to that I control handling here. Okay, I think I'm pretty early already with my talk, so I hope you have a lot of questions. Conclusion for now is, well, there's no easy answer for you if you want to write a user space interface in your kernel driver. There are lots of different options. You can have I/O controls, you can have read-write operations, you can have netlink, or you can write your own file system. You should not implement something completely new, but use what's there. And some things have gone out of fashion. PROCFS is definitely way out of fashion. Netlink is mostly discouraged now. File systems are currently still what's recommended, but some people already said that, well, we're already making it too easy for people to add new file systems, and we should probably have a watch to how many we're adding. Yes, question?
Okay, so the question is, when I add a new component to the kernel, and I want to have some interface, and extend the file systems, it's pretty much doing that.
Okay, so the question, just for the camera, is it always better to use an existing file system, or should you add a new file system when adding a completely new component? And of course, the answer is that it depends. So if you have a device driver that deals with devices that are already in SysFS, the natural way is to add these files to SysFS. DebugFS is used mostly for things that are not stable. And I should have mentioned that earlier when I said that all these interfaces need to be kept stable. DebugFS is the one exception where we say we're not maintaining the ABI on any file in DebugFS. If you use DebugFS in your application, you're screwed. And if a device driver writer uses DebugFS for something that should be a stable API, then we should tell him to use something different. And what I'm trying to do with the libfs simplification is to make it easier for you to add a new file system for a special purpose. But you should do that only if there's not already a file system for that purpose in the kernel. OK, any more questions? Yeah. ConfigFS, yeah. I actually haven't looked at ConfigFS, but I think it's only used by one or two subsystems in the kernel, and it's probably right. And I think the other one is also from Oracle, so it's Oracle ConfigFS. And it's I think that when I'm done with the DebugFS to libfs conversion, all of ConfigFS should come down to less than 10 lines. You can still use that, but you can just write your own 10 lines. Okay. Okay. So ConfigFS is more transaction-based rather than have a single value that you're manipulating. Yeah. Okay. Any other questions? Or I would phrase it differently. You said, make sure that you document it. I would say, make sure it's documented. It may even be better to have someone else document it, because that means that you're forcing someone else to try and understand what you do, and then you can verify that what he understood from your code is actually what you meant. But the important part is make sure that you have documentation for an interface that goes into the kernel. Right. So at the summit, in Cambridge, we talked about this for some time. There was also a talk by the Manpages maintainer, Michael Kurisk, who had the point that we should always have documentation for anything that goes into the kernel. And we should give some really nice examples of how he found bugs in the kernel code while trying to write documentation for it. And of course, documentation is most useful for the people who want to use it, but it's also useful for the people who are writing some component to see if they did the right things there. Yeah, he found one example that could not have worked possibly, yeah. Okay, any other questions? Yep. Yeah.
There's a couple of files where the stable AVI is currently questioned, namely the proc mem info and to some degree also sysfs, because
I think you mean proc slab info, not proc mem info?
Or proc slab info, yes.
Yeah.
But proc mem info is basically the same because it's in a way not the description of a stable API or API, but the description of internal structures of the kernel.
Yep.
And now we get to the messy question, how stable should the internal structures of the kernel remain just to keep the API stable?
Right. We have a similar problem with sysfs, because sysfs always represents the relation between objects in the kernel. Every object, every K object, that's the kernel data structure, is represented as a directory in sysfs. And if you change how they fit together, you will also change the directory layout in sysfs. And that's a nasty problem that we have. There's not much we can do about it except tell people not to implement things in a way that might change.
The way that sysfs was a bad idea.
No, I think sysfs helped us a lot. In some points it went too far, and some points it was misused. So I think with the case of slab info, we actually ended up having a new proc slab info that just looks the same as the old one. So we maintain the ABI, but it's actually based on completely different data structures that don't make any sense with the interface. Okay, any other questions?
So Kirkmon has been on this thing, just used API for a long time.
Oh, yeah.
Is that a long discussion we could avoid right now?
I would love to have the discussion, maybe not during this talk, but.
I'm curious. You seem to be almost done, and we've got 25 minutes to care.
Okay.
I think it's 10
Yeah. I mean, I also think that. Jörn was not sure if he has enough time for his talk, so.
But he is fixed up.
Oh, all right, yeah. Is Christoph here already? No, who's next? Okay. Yeah, so we could talk about Perfmon.
Well, I'm just curious what the perspective is, because, I mean, Perfmon had a lot of back and forth on what the right API was, right? And it's a very performance-sensitive, very lightweight.
Yeah.
I think one takeaway from the first one discussion is that we're close to it now.
how exactly what you're doing, and kind of using yourself to interact with it somehow before you put the judgment.
Yeah. It's actually been reviewed several times too. Somewhat like you heard earlier on. It's been out of three forever, but it's gone through several that we've got here.
Yeah. So I think in the case of Perfmon 2, I haven't looked at the original Perfmon, but Perfmon 2 at least, it looks like something we really want to have, but the system call interface is really complex. It's like 10 new system calls, and each of them takes a different data structure, and I think we can do better than that. We should really try our best to simplify these data structures and come up with a simpler version of the interface. Maybe have a file system like a ProfileFS, but I think they must have looked at that earlier and for some reason went to a system call based interface. So,
so that those kind of system calls, is that the result of Andy's review? Because I know there was some discussion about the system call API, the initial system call API, but someone else put out.
Yeah. I'm not sure if it actually changed.
I think it did change. It was one API that had one particular call, and it didn't put it out.
Okay, yeah, well, that's the first step. So one thing that you should always avoid, of course, is a multiplex system call, where you have one system call that does lots of different things. The next best thing is to have a number of system calls, each doing something unique. But then you should look at each of those system calls and try to simplify it as much as possible. And I'm not sure if they did the second step of that. Yeah, sure. It's always hard. As I had in the beginning, it's always hard to do something simple.